From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, it's Politically Georgia. I'm Greg Bluestein, today with early voting for the May races already underway and the presidential contest gaining steam. We'll start with a conversation with Republican consultant Brian Robinson.
I'm Patricia Murphy. Unrest over Israel's war against Hamas continued on Georgia campuses Monday. About 300 students staged a protest at Emory University, and several were arrested at the University of Georgia at a protest on that campus. We'll talk about that with the AJC's Athens reporter, Fletcher Page.
Plus, I'm Bill Nygut. Vice President Harris was back in Atlanta to begin a nationwide tour touting the Biden administration's effort to create greater economic opportunities for Black Americans.
Don't give up, because we need you. Our country needs you. And that's how we're going to be strong.
We invite you to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode of Politically Georgia. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over four decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.
From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this is Politically Georgia, setting the stakes and the agenda for Georgia politics every weekday morning. Guys, we have a brief musical interlude.
Patricia, Tia, Bill, and Greg, they put together a show that's meant to be led by Shaney, B, and Natalie. Politically Georgia for you and for me.
For longtime listeners of the show, that is my daughter, Brooke Bluestein, who is still on spring break after, what, a week and a half? She's still here, and every time she comes into the show, she has to sing that interlude, that beautiful rap, Brian Robinson. By you as well, and it's your birthday, so consider that your early birthday present.
Yeah, I was hoping for a birthday rap from a Bluestein family member.
Well, it's your 29th, so maybe for
maybe next year.
Well, Bill, I think before we really launch into the news of the day, you have something to
do. My wife Janice and I are so, so happy. Our close friend, Kenny Leon, who still makes his home in Atlanta when he's not directing plays on Broadway. The Tony nominations were announced this morning. I was here in the studio watching them live, and Kenny was nominated again for Best Director of a play called Pearly Victorious, which, by the way, was written by Ossie Davis, a Georgian himself, and the play is set in Georgia. It's a very it's a very funny, interestingly enough, play about race in Georgia that works well. Leslie Odom Jr., who made his name in Hamilton, is also nominated for leading actor. There are at least three other nominations, and Kenny Leon is a treasure to this community and to a theater in the United States. And we're just so thrilled for him this morning.
Patricia, I think we just got a sneak peek of who's up for the week for Bill Nye.
Yeah. Greg, I don't have any famous friends except for Brian Robinson. So congratulations, Brian, for being on the show.
Thank you. I'm up today. I'm up.
You are up because it is your 29th birthday. Happy birthday. We're going to dive deeper into the show in a few minutes with a live report from Athens. But let's start with the growing campus protest here in Georgia, because dozens of pro-Palestinian protesters were arrested last week at Emory University. This week, demonstrators have tried multiple times to set up encampments at UGA. Brian, as you know, Republicans are taking a very hard line on this. We're hearing some of the same words mimicked. Burt Jones and Kelly Loeffler both called these demonstrators pro-terrorist radicals. This is kind of part of a law and order approach that Republicans are really leaning into, even though most of these demonstrators are peaceful.
You know, Greg, when was one of the last times we saw campus demonstrations that turned violent across this country. You know, you think about 1968 before either you or I were on this planet. But, you know, what happened in that year? Richard Nixon, who had lost election after election, had seemed to be politically doomed, was resurrected and entered the White House. Because when people see chaos on their TV screens, when they get scared by violence, they want a law and order message. They want leadership that's going to make them feel safe, make their families feel secure. And this is not the atmosphere that Democrats are going to want in an election year, because voters, American voters, are probably somewhat split on some of this Israeli Gaza stuff. I think there's a lot of support for Israel. At the same time, I think that's leavened by concern by how extreme some of the desperate situation in Gaza is. So it's not quite as strong as it was 6-8 months ago. But the folks who are on these campuses bringing tents, breaking through police lines, that's not the image that you want if you're somebody who wants to see relief given to Gaza. There's going to be a backlash to this, folks, if they go too far. And I think they're really on the verge of doing that. I don't think there's a lot of sympathy for them when they get arrested, when these faculty members are telling the cameras who they are. They think that they are immune. They think that they are above the law, and they're not. They need to be fired if their campuses and their universities are saying, you can't do this. This is against university policy. If they go and do it anyway, they need to be let go. There needs to be an example made.
Well, Brian, I think you might be exaggerating just a bit the extent to which these protests, certainly here in Georgia, on the Emory campus at the University of Georgia, have been violent. There has been very little violence at all. In fact, I think of the Emory students arrested, there were only one or two who were charged with anything that approached charges that they participated in some kind of violent action. These are mostly peaceful protests. And I think some of the, and we should also point out that the president of Emory, President Fenves, had to apologize because he initially said that apparently one of the reasons they sent police in when that protest started, when that tent encampment was starting to get organized, he said these are outsiders who are coming onto our campus, which does suggest, you know, these are people who might be provoking violence in some way. He had to apologize because it turned out that wasn't the case at all. So I think you're right that there probably will be among some people a real backlash to even these quiet demonstrations, these sit-ins, whatever you want to call them. But I think be careful before you talk about how much violence there's been. There's been very little.
It's not all in Georgia, Bill.
I understand.
That's part of a national optics that we're seeing here. And whether it's in New York or California or in Georgia, it's what we are being served up on the TV news and on the radio. So I still think it is something that makes people feel like there's chaos in the country. And that is a situation where people want to see a law and order message. And look, I saw a video of people breaking through a police line in Georgia. Now, are they burning buildings down? Are shots being fired? No. But you are seeing people, you know, in physical altercations with police. I think it could be a tinderbox moment, Bill, as much as anything. I hope it doesn't get any worse than it is. I don't want to see anything get more violent than this.
Well, I think there is a balance that all these campuses are trying to strike between the right to protest, which is very real, very American, happens a lot on college campuses, and there's a tradition of it on college campuses. But at the same time, some of these images are extremely violent. This morning at Columbia University, a main building being overtaken by protesters with hammers, barricading themselves inside, that has gone too far. And I say it's gone too far because I'm hearing from parents of students at Columbia who cannot go to class right now. Some of them are Jewish, some of them are not. All of them are too scared to go to campus, and they can't go anyway because they don't have classes. So Columbia is a place where this is very clearly they've lost the balance there. You have to balance the right of the protesters with the right of the other students. especially Jewish students and their parents, not to feel harassed and intimidated. I hate to see Republicans who want to be governor in 2026 weighing in on this right now, because it's too serious to just be a talking point. Like, there are Jewish students who are scared. There are Palestinian Americans who have family in Gaza who are dying. This is a real situation, and very much like the Vietnam War protests, there will be consequences that we cannot imagine. At that time, American soldiers came home and felt ashamed of their service, largely because of those protests. So I think it's a campus by campus situation. A place like Vanderbilt, where I went, I think is striking the right balance. Columbia, where I also went, has totally lost it.
I think you're absolutely correct, Patricia, to talk about the balance. Again, on Georgia campuses, we haven't seen much violence. Columbia, they have gone over the line. But and I think when you say you hate to think about people who are going to run for higher office in 2026 taking advantage of this, I think they're playing into the hand that Brian is dealing right now, talking about the violence that is happening everywhere. The right to protest peacefully is still enshrined in basic American constitutional law. I'm the only one on this panel, of course, who actually participated in anti-war protests during the Vietnam War in Chicago, of all places. And for the most part, even at times when we would block a given street in downtown Chicago, police didn't arrest in the early days of those protests. They kind of gently put, or sometimes not too gently, moved us aside and recognized it was going to happen again the next day. And then, of course, the convention happened, and that's when it all went south.
Brian, we should note real quick that you are also not only a consultant, but you're also one of the advisors to Attorney General Chris Carr, who could be running for governor, is expected to run for governor in a couple of years. And he also came out with a statement saying he was proud of how UGA law enforcement responded to that protest a couple yesterday in swiftly disbanding the encampment.
That's right. And, you know, and turnabout's fair play. So I think Bill is exaggerating when he says that Republicans have taken advantage of this situation. They are speaking on a topic of great public interest, and one that will involve local authorities here in Georgia. And we're seeing that at the University of Georgia. I can tell you, I am also a good friend of UGA President Jerry Moorhead. And he is somebody who is going to strike that right balance. No one questions the right of Americans, college students, anyone else, to speak out. They have the right not only to speak out, they have the right to say things that I find offensive. They have the right to say things that other students find offensive. I don't believe in these safe spaces. I will fight for their rights to go out there and say things that don't meet my worldview. But when they bring tents onto the lawn and the school says you can't do that, when they spray graffiti on the walls and the school says you can't do that, if there's a police line and they break through it, that's when you begin to cross the line. That's not peaceful protest, and that's not how this needs to be handled. So I think what you're seeing from Republican leaders in this state is a reflection of Republican voters in this state. They are upset about what happened October 7th. They believe in Israel's right to defend itself. But no one is questioning the right of these students to speak their minds.
Patricia, we've talked about the Republican response. Let's talk about the Democrats, because Democrats are really struggling. They're wrestling with how to respond. We've seen some Democrats just stay silent entirely. Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens is among them. We've seen some Democrats criticize law enforcement. We've seen others stand up for the Jewish community and really reflect some of the angst in the Jewish community over these protests. We had former Democratic Congresswoman Carolyn Bordeaux on our show last week, and she said this issue could be the dagger in the heart of the fragile Democratic coalition that helped elect Joe Biden in Georgia in 2020. Patricia.
Yeah, well, I think there is a great danger there for President Biden, because for him, his choices right now in the Middle East are not driven by politics. That's very clear, because it's politically not that smart for him right now. He's wading into very dangerous waters because there is a young, diverse coalition of voters that the Democrats needed to win in 2020 and need again to win in 2024. Now, I think the real question is, what does it look like in November? It could look very different than it does now. And will influencers, for lack of a better word, will Gen Z and millennial leaders who are Democrats and progressives step forward and say, hey, it would only get worse under Donald Trump? I mean, there's going to need to be some leadership inside that coalition, and they'll have to decide. I could stay home, of course, but is it going to be better with Donald Trump instead of Joe Biden in the White House? That's the question for them.
I think it's important that we make clear that what Carolyn Bordeaux, you described, Greg, when she talked about the dagger to the heart, was not talking about the protest. She was talking about the way in which Biden was responding
this
to the war
yes.
between Israel and Hamas, just to clarify that. And it is certainly true that President Biden is in an extraordinarily difficult position here. He wants to support America's most important ally in the Middle East, thinking down the road, Israel is of enormous importance as a strategic partner to the United States. At the same time, he cannot convince the far-right Israeli government led by Benjamin Netanyahu that they have taken the wrong approach in decimating large sections of Gaza. It's no wonder that there is pushback from so many people as they see hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people displaced from their homes, children being killed in what appears to be indiscriminate bombing. The president, strike, it seems to me, to be in a virtually impossible position until he can get Netanyahu and that far-right government to think more clearly about what they're doing to their own future.
And there are reports this morning about new traction of peace talks between Israel, Hamas, and the Gaza war, but we'll see if those go anywhere. But Brian, building on that thread that Bill just mentioned, yesterday, Vice President Kamala Harris came to town. She didn't say anything about the protest or the Israel-Hamas war. She was focusing on Black economic growth, on economic opportunities, on her administration's agenda. You know, Brian, this always, I've always viewed this as not, about whether or not Donald Trump is really going to gain traction among Black voters here in Georgia, where getting 10% is a huge victory for any Republican. And you worked for former Governor Nathan Deal, who celebrated getting 10% of the African-American vote back in 2014. But it's really a question to me, at least, not between Biden and Trump, but between Biden and the couch, between Biden and apathy.
That's right. It's a matter of, for a lot of these voters, are they going to come home to the Democratic Party or are they going to stay home when it comes to the election? And I think a lot of that has to do with the economy. All of this, there's all of this stuff that's going on. Like, how many people in this country are going to vote just on this Israel-Gaza issue? I don't know. I can't imagine that it's a massive number, but it doesn't take a lot in Georgia when you have such a small margin. I heard Karl Rove say recently that a 1% reduction in Black turnout in 2020 would have given the election in Georgia to Donald Trump. It just goes to show you how just a small bit of movement will have big consequences in a state like this, a state like Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. So these things matter in that context. What I think this comes down to, though, Greg, is where are people going to feel on the economy at the end of the year? I think Republicans have some challenges, some backlash on the abortion issue. Democrats have some challenges on this issue, Gaza, Israel dividing their base. And so there, some of that cancels out in my mind, and then the economy becomes the big issue. Kamala Harris coming here in for her 12th visit, as you guys reported yesterday, to go do specifically Black events shows that they are still trying to consolidate their base. They should be in a get out the vote operation now. Instead, they are in a persuasion operation. They're trying to get folks they've got to have to stay on the team. And if you don't have to take my word for it, look at what Kamala Harris did yesterday. That's exactly what she is doing. They're trying to shore up that support. And at the very least, make sure they don't become Trump voters. Now, I will say that 10% margin, Greg, is a little bit out of date. I think Republicans now can get into the high teens. Mm. We've seen polling in your paper that shows Republicans getting over 20%. I do not think that's going to happen this year.
Yeah.
It's going to come down, particularly as people feel the economy is getting better. But Republicans are making inroads with that black electorate, and that will have profound electoral consequences in Georgia for the next generation.
Okay, just a minute. I just have to weigh in here. So, yes, the Democrats are still, they need to get out the vote. Donald Trump is trying to get out of jail. I mean, we need to have a symmetrical conversation about the realities of this election. Although, in some ways, voters do seem almost totally immune to the realities of Donald Trump right now. Democrats are also going to, and I promise you they will, really start to turn up the heat on President Trump, former President Trump, and remind voters exactly what they'd be getting, whether they vote for him directly or just stay at home on their couch. Either one is helpful to Donald Trump. And that will be the message we hear from Democrats going into the fall. I do also think Kamala Harris herself is a bit of an issue for the Democrats. I have to be honest. She comes to town, nobody blinks. You know, she's not lighting up a stage. And because of Joe Biden's age, there you have to look to her and evaluate her as a potential president. There's no way around it. And I think right now that's a bit of an issue for Democrats, too.
You know,
I totally agree. Let me say here, Bill, that when it comes to Trump's got his own issues, he certainly does. But we know what the facts of those cases are. Are we waiting for 12 random people to tell us what we should think of it? I don't think so. And we're now in year 9 of Democrats telling us that the bottom is about to fall out under Donald Trump. So we're still waiting on that bottom to fall out.
So what's interesting about this, Brian, is that what we really have is a race between two incumbents. Donald Trump just happens to be in the incumbent from four plus years ago. And what's fascinating and helpful for Republicans, and I'm interested in your thinking about this, Brian, is Trump amnesia. This notion that people now think, well, you know, he really did a pretty good job. COVID, I don't remember what he did during COVID when he suggested that we should ingest bleach. I don't remember the chaos that surrounded him. I think basically, that tax break that wealthy people got, not us. It's funny that Trump amnesia seems to be working in his favor as the former incumbent.
Well, you know, we as Americans, I think these voters are probably just as humans. We do move on. But let's not forget, you know, pre-COVID, we had a 4% or below unemployment rate. Interest rates were very low. People could buy homes if they wanted to. It kept student loan repayments down lower as well. Everyone had a job. We weren't in global wars that were and hot spots and spending all this money on supporting allies. So in some ways, and I'm not saying Joe Biden's the reason why we have global hot spots right now, but in some ways, we felt like we were in a more secure spot at that moment in time. And we can have different partisan views on why that is. Maybe it was just luck. Maybe it was Trump's brilliance. Who knows? It probably depends on where you are politically on that. But I think the amnesia is, I think some of the amnesia is on the Democrat side, that things economically and globally were better off pre-COVID under Trump.
Okay. I'm not trying to have a debate with Brian Robinson at all.
Oh, but it's so fun.
I'm going to have a symmetrical conversation. So I'm just going to add a few facts here. The current unemployment rate is under 4%. It's 3.8%. Interest rates have gone up because that so much money went out the door during COVID with PPP loans and following additional huge spending and tax cuts by both Democrats and Republicans. So let's just get the facts on the table. And people were afraid during Donald Trump's presidency, but it was over what was happening inside our own country, including on January 6th. People were afraid to open their eyes in the morning and see what the newspaper was telling us had happened overnight while we were sleeping. I mean, it was a time of immense anxiety that we all lived. Some of it was Donald Trump's fault. Some of it was not. But again, we have to be honest about the facts of the situation then and now.
But here's the political reality of it, though, Patricia, is that when it comes to inflation, it is the incumbent president who plays the political price for it, not the previous president. And that's the reality. That's totally asymmetrical.
I agree, yes. But he doesn't even set the inflation rate. That's the Fed. So he, you know, again, Joe Biden paying the price for some people's decisions.
Guys, you're lecturing a college course on this. I'm talking about politics.
We got to take a break, but this does remind me of one of the jokes, the zingers that Colin Jost had at the White House Correspondents Association dinner. This is it. The Republican candidate for president owes $500 million in fines for bank fraud. He's currently spending his days farting himself awake during a porn star husband trial, and the race is tied.
Exactly.
Well, Brian Robinson, happy birthday. Go enjoy your day. We really appreciate you
joining us. Happy day, Brian.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for coming.
And when we return, we'll continue our conversation as more protests have broken out on college campuses over that war in Gaza. This time at UGA, we'll get an update from the AJC's Fletcher page on what happened after the break. This is Politically Georgia from the AJC.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach. An air freshener can make your car smell like paradise. A drive to Daytona Beach will actually get you there. Beach on. Plan your trip today at DaytonaBeach.com.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Twice daily, delivered straight to your email, you can receive the AJC's Politically Georgia newsletter. Stay on top of all the important news, scoops, and exclusives from me and the rest of the AJC politics team. Just go to ajc.com/newsletters and sign up today. That's ajc.com/newsletters. I'm Greg Bluestein. I'm here with Bill Nigut and Patricia Murphy. Early yesterday morning, police broke up an encampment at the University of Georgia's North Campus and charged several demonstrators with trespassing. They vowed to come back today to protest the pro-Israel stance in the Israel-Hamas war. We're now joined by our AJC colleague, Fletcher Page, our Athens bureau chief, to give us an update. Fletcher, what are you seeing on the ground there at UGA today?
Yeah, hey, Greg. Yeah, right now there's been an off and on light drizzle. And so there's a group of about 12 people that are huddled under some trees near the UGA chapel, which is close to the old college lawn where the protest happened yesterday. So I was able to speak to one person with that group who said there's really no game plan at the moment. They're playing it by ear. I'm not really sure if the weather is the reason why things have kind of gone off track, but there are protesters here, and it looks like they're just sort of huddled and waiting at the moment.
And Fletcher, you were there yesterday when law enforcement quickly disbanded that encampment. We heard Governor Brian Kemp say a couple days ago that his advice, his counsel to law enforcement is to lock them up. He said a harsher word than that, but he said his advice is going to be lock them up. We saw that with UGA police. There is really strict rules about encampments and protests on that part of university property anyway. But were there any complaints from the students? What was the response from those demonstrators as they got dispersed?
Yeah, I think, the UGA did use some of the policies that they've outlined to make those arrests in terms of, you know, erecting tents and barricades. You can't block sidewalks. So I've been able to confirm that they arrested 16 people. 10 of them were UGA students. All 16 have been released from jail. But what came out of that yesterday was a much larger protest that galvanized hours later around 3 p.m. at the Arch. And that protest that lasted, there was well over 100 people included there. They marched around North Campus and eventually settled in back at the old campus lawn where the original protest was. And they were here until around 9 p.m. last night. So the original protest had about 25 people, and then the protest in response had over 100.
And we've got some audio from that protest yesterday.
Order to disperse. Anyone who does not do so will be arrested for criminal trespass and may be subject to additional consequences.
Are you proud, Jane? How do you sleep at night? Do you have kids? Jane, do you have kids?
So, Fletcher, was there any violence at all? I want to, you know, reflect back on our conversation a few minutes ago, which you may not have heard much of, with Brian Robinson, who talked about violence. And it's true, there's violence in other universities around the country. This was a pretty peaceful protest, yes?
Correct. Yeah. You know, some of the language was pretty harsh, but yeah, it was a peaceful protest.
I just wonder when you tell us that a light drizzle is preventing people from turning out to protest against a war that they feel is not only unjust, but killing thousands and thousands of civilians. They don't sound like the bloodthirsty hordes that have been actually involved in demonstrations on other campuses. That's for sure.
Right. Yeah. And again, you know, we're talking about the first protest had maybe 25 people involved. So like I said, the response to the response was much larger, you know, to answer your question sort of about, you know, what the vibe was.
Yeah. And it seemed calibrated to send a message, right? Just like the Emory response too, to send a message that these encampments won't be tolerated. Patricia?
Yeah. Fletcher, what do you mean by harsh language? Was it just sort of generalized yelling? Was it anything to do with specifically with Jewish students or Israel itself? What were they yelling about?
Some of the language, I mean, they were calling President Jerry Moorhead out by name, and also the Dean of Students, Eric Atkinson. But once, so the original protests around 8 a.m. Monday morning, those protesters linked arms. There's about 20 of them at this point. And police started to come in and grab one by one and arrest them, put them in handcuffs. And once that started happening, a lot of onlookers and people sort of adjacent to the protest really turned their vitriol toward the police and UGA Police Chief Jeffrey Clark. So there was a lot of layers to sort of where a lot of that language was pointed. And once arrests started happening, you know, things really got intense between people that were what I would call onlookers, and sort of participating in the protest, and what they were saying to police.
We're here with Fletcher Page, the AJC's Athens Bureau Chief. Fletcher, you have a report out today about some other action that university officials have taken. A student says she's been suspended for participating in Monday's campus, and also that the group Students for Justice in Palestine has also been suspended. What update do you have for us on that?
Yes, correct. Senior Zina Muhammad, who's been, you know, she's kind of an organizer for the Students for Justice in Palestine. She was one of the 10 students arrested on Monday morning. When she was able to get out of jail, she came back to the original site of the protest, where there were about 100 people by that point, around 4:30 or 5 p.m. And then at 5:02 p.m., she received an email from UGA that said that she had about 10 minutes to respond, or that she would receive an interim suspension. And so she did not see that email. By the time she did, her time had passed to be able to speak for herself. So she was suspended, and she had to leave campus immediately. She had a conversation with the Dean of Students, Eric Atkinson, at that point, and Zina was removed. Georgia cited that for the students that have been suspended, I've been able to confirm that 7 of those students have been suspended. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to confirm if all 10, but some of the language they used in the letter, they cited reckless disruption or obstruction of teaching, research, administration, or other university activities. So there is an opportunity for those students to appeal. They have until May 6th. But for a student like Zina Muhammad, she expected to graduate and go through commencement on May 10th. So that's been kind of put into question now.
Hmm. One last one for you, Fletcher, before we let you go. But how is this? All these protests are happening in the last weeks of the school year. Graduation's right around the corner, as you just mentioned. How is this affecting any of the plans for graduation on Georgia's flagship university's campus?
Currently, there are no plans to alter anything with commencement May the 10th for undergraduates. Right now, everything is on schedule. So Georgia is moving forward.
Well, thanks, Fletcher, for joining us, providing that quick update. We're going to see you again soon.
You bet. Thanks, guys.
Patricia, with the backdrop of these college protests in mind, I want to pivot to you and the column you wrote in Sunday's paper about safe spaces for Jewish students on campus, and a really hard conversation you had with an old friend of yours.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody with a high school junior, and they're starting to think about where to go to college. And it's a Jewish family, and she said, my daughter just feels lost right now. They don't know where she might want to go to college because all of this is happening. They just quite literally don't know where they could send her away, and she would still feel safe. Places where she had thought she would go, assumed she would go in the Northeast, just don't seem like possibilities anymore. And more than that, it's just the idea that as a Jewish family, they didn't think they would ever feel this way in America. I mean, many Jewish families are in America because they fled the Holocaust, and to suddenly feel targeted because of their religion in the country that they sought refuge. It's also the country where many Muslim families have sought refuge, where many Palestinian families have sought refuge. But it is suddenly really coming at a cost to these families' own sense of security. And it's just a place they never thought they would be at this time in their lives.
It's so troubling. In my own family, I have family members, because we're a Jewish family, who say that they're frightened right now. They feel that they are less secure than they've been. I don't agree with that. I continue to feel pretty secure right here in my own community, but I understand why some people don't. And you know, here's what troubles me so much about this is a misrepresentation or a misunderstanding necessarily of how Jews are reacting to the war against Hamas. We know that there are any number of people in the Jewish community who are very troubled by the extent of the devastation being done to the people of Gaza. The resistance of the Israeli government to allow massive relief to get into Gaza. To be a Jew today does not necessarily mean you support the way in which the war is being prosecuted, even if you understand that the horror of October 7th needed a response. At the same time, you can talk about Zionism in different ways. My in-laws met for the first time at a party at the Commerce Club, which is the old mm-hmm. Jewish country club in Atlanta. And the party was for the celebration of the founding of the state of Israel. They would have called themselves Zionists because they believed that Jews deserved a place where they could be safe. But to be a Zionist and believe in the promise of Israel as a pluralistic society is not the same as being a Zionist who wants to wipe out Palestinians, which we know some far-right Zionists do believe is correct. It's much more complicated. And yet, of course, anti-Semitism is running at a fever pitch today without regard to any of the complexities of what it really means.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think for these families in particular, you know, many of these families don't support Netanyahu, hate what's happening in Gaza, are horrified by what they're seeing on their own television screens, but also faced with questioning why administrations on these college campuses seem not to be worried about Jewish students' safety. And I'll point to Columbia specifically. A student there had a disciplinary hearing months ago and said Zionists must die. And that student was not disciplined until 4 days ago. Yeah. And that's a problem. That is a problem for a family that is considering sending their kid to Columbia. Now, that's a very rarefied group. But considering, if you're thinking about sending them to Columbia, the administration takes a responsibility for their safety mm-hmm. when they're there in their dorms, going to classes. They can't do that anymore. And that is what these families are feeling from all of this. They're not getting yelled at. They're in high school. They're feeling really good right now. But suddenly they're thinking about the University of Alabama instead of going, you know, trying for an Ivy League school, because they just don't feel safe watching these images on TV. And that is having a profound impact. And as much as Democrats, I think, need to worry about that young progressive coalition, they're going to need to start worrying about Jewish voter support as well.
How the SEC becomes the Ivy League. But guys, this is really? This is sort of that underlying challenge, though, because most Democrats, the one, you know, the party that's really wrestling the most over these protests, they say they both support free speech and condemn anti-Semitism, but where do you draw that line? Where do you distinguish between legitimate criticism of the Israeli government and its very unpopular leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, and what is anti-Semitic speech?
Well, I mean, that's exactly the question that is a complicated one to answer. It strikes me that you can be a believer in the importance of Israel as a safe haven for Jews, and by the way, for Arabs as well, who are citizens of Israel, without supporting, again, Benjamin Netanyahu. I think polling of Israelis right now continues to say that while Israelis support the war because of October 7th, given the chance to throw out Benjamin Netanyahu, a majority of Israelis want him gone. They're not happy with the way he's prosecuting the war, but more important, they're not happy because he did so little to prepare Israel for the October 7th attacks.
I know this is a complicated conversation. I'm going to leave it there for now. We're going to have all the answers for you tomorrow on tomorrow's show. But no, just ahead, the Biden administration has Georgia on their mind as they mount a reelection campaign. I was there yesterday as Vice President Kamala Harris made her 12th trip to Georgia since taking office. I'll recap her remarks after the break with State Representative Billy Mitchell. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Hip-hop is a product of Black people. It's a product of Black song and celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents
hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop story.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny.
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at ajc.com/hip-hop.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The AJC has a special offer for Politically Georgia podcast listeners. If you subscribe today, you can get 3 months of unlimited digital access for just 99 cents. That's all of our breaking news, politics, investigations, business, sports, food, and dining. Plus a whole lot more. Access to our e-paper, the AJC app, our assortment of newsletters. So you can take advantage of this special offer for podcast listeners only by going to ajc.com/startA. That's ajc.com/startA. This introductory special is for new subscribers only. I'm Greg Bluestein here with Patricia Murphy and Bill Nygut. I joined the vice president during her quick trip to Georgia yesterday, and one of the most prominent Democratic leaders in the crowd from here in Georgia was State Representative Billy Mitchell, who joins us now. Representative Mitchell, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, good to be here. Certainly grateful that you're having me, thinking I have something to contribute to the conversation.
Well, of course you do. And you're a longtime Democratic leader and one of the chamber's top, the House Democratic Chamber's top Democratic leaders. So let's start with the topic we've been talking about here today. And one topic the vice president didn't address yesterday in Georgia, because she was here to talk about the economy, but those ongoing campus protests. Representative, as you know, Democrats are really wrestling over how to respond to the Israel-Hamas war and a lot of backlash within your own party. Even former Congresswoman Carolyn Bordeaux said it could really be a threat. This whole issue could be a threat to Joe Biden's reelection campaign. What's your view of how the party should be handling and responding to these protests?
Well, I take the view that while we certainly ought to be concerned with innocents and children killed and injured. But I think there's no excuse for what's going on in our college campuses, to be quite candid with you. Much of the actions that are taken by protesters resembles, in my mind, what we saw on January 6th. I don't think that we can criticize what happened in January 6th and say this is acceptable. As we speak, there are buildings in the Columbia University campus that are literally closed down as a result of what's going on. I am sympathetic to the Arabs and the situation that is going on, but we can't deny the growing of the proliferation of the anti-Semitic attitude that is going through this country. And I think that we ought to be able to have discussions and dialogue, and we ought to be able to protest in such a way that it doesn't put people in peril. So far as the political ramifications, at the end of the day, I always find that if you do what's right, at the end of the day, you'll be rewarded for that. Oftentimes, when you just try to do the what is politically expedient, it just has a way of coming back and having the opposite effect. So we should do what's right. Certainly, vandalism and destroying property and preventing graduations to occur is not right. And I think everyone can agree with that.
Patricia?
Representative Mitchell, let's also talk about Kamala Harris's visit to Georgia yesterday. By coming here to Georgia, we know that this remains a crucial battleground state. We are also seeing a lot of polling, and I just don't know what to make of polls these days because they seem to be kind of up and down. But what's your sense of how President Biden is doing right now among that core group of Black voters he needs to have to win here in Georgia? What does he need to do for you to feel good about where things stand today?
I think what he needs to do is what his handlers have started to point him in the direction. He needs to get out and tell his story. He needs to show the average everyday person what he showed at the correspondents' dinner, that he is glib, that he has a personality, and that he can walk and chew bubble gum at the same time. His policies have been extraordinary for the community, even not only the community that are considered his base, but for all America. I think getting out and telling the story, as Kamala Harris is started in Atlanta yesterday, is what needs to happen for sure. And I remember 4 years ago, we were looking at polls, and we thought that Georgia was going to not be really in play, and I know it by heart now. Would be he won the state by 11,738 votes or whatever it was. I can quote that now. But the reality is there are a lot of people who aren't even focused in the election now, particularly among his base, that as we get closer to the time to vote in November, it will be certainly a different kind of refrain that's going on. Somebody asked me the other day, when is Beyonce going to weigh in? When is Taylor Swift going to weigh in? And when they do, it's all over for Trump.
Representative Mitchell, it's Bill Nugget.
See, Bill.
One of the questions, though, is a ground game in Georgia, a grassroots effort. Fair fight is not the force that it was when Stacey Abrams put that group together and they became such a powerful grassroots voter turnout operation. We don't see that here in Georgia. It's not visible at this point today. And the question is, who does pick up from where Fair Fight left off? Obviously the Biden campaign is bringing some operatives into the state. They'll do their best effort, but it takes far more than the campaign organization itself. And it doesn't appear that that kind of group has coalesced here yet. Where are they going to come from, Representative?
Well, I will tell you, the strategies that were largely led by groups like Fair Fight are just now common campaigning at the moment. I will tell you that before Fair Fight, Georgia was one of the worst states in the nation so far as voter registration. Mm-hmm. Every campaign season, we literally had to register hundreds of thousands of voters. As a result of the motor voter bill, now Georgia is one or two in voter registration. So those kinds of efforts no longer need to be had. We now concentrate on getting our voters to the poll. The reality is elections really aren't about who's on the ballot. Elections are really about who's in the booth. What we're concentrating on now is getting our people to the booth at the appropriate time. Now, what I'm saying, I can say this publicly because the other side knows it as well. And how the other side has been operating is such that they are trying to create impediments to keep people from going to the booth. If you compare our policies, they're more mainstream. More of America appreciates our policies. And I think that's what Biden needs to do, is go out and talk about his story. Common sense gun regulation. Last poll I seen was something like in the 70 percentile in this country. Women's health care. Last I looked, it was, you know, almost 80% of folks agreed with women's health care. Even in Georgia, expanding Medicaid. We're one of the few states, including conservative states, that has not embraced expanding Medicaid. And as chair of the Democratic caucus, one of the things that I am doing is, we've traditionally said expanding Medicaid is going to help people. It's going to help poor people, underinsured, and the like. And what the other side paints us as, these liberals, they want to give away the state's money, want the state to be parents of constituents. We no longer can use that language. We have to use their language. Expanding Medicaid will be good for business. The reality is, the largest economic generator in this state, and certainly in the rural areas, is the local hospital. And it creates jobs. It creates other economic opportunities. If you don't believe that, go to the corridor of Atlanta Medical Center and see what the closing of that hospital has done to that community.
We're here with State Representative Billy Mitchell, one of the top Democrats in the Georgia House and one of President Biden's key surrogates here in Georgia. Billy, before you joined the show, we had Republican consultant Brian Robinson on, who said the fact that Vice President Harris was playing to the party's base here in Georgia, with not just the event yesterday, but other events earlier, voting rights, abortion rights, playing to the base rather than trying to expand the electorate, is a real warning sign that she's in persuasion mode and not in expansion mode. How do you see that?
I see it just the opposite. The reality is I teach some classes on the college level, and I remember an old professor told me, is that you first tell people what you're going to do it, and then you tell them what you did. And that's what the administration is doing. They're making sure that the base understands all the great things that are happening. I tell you, most the average voter is not tuned into this the way we are. And that's just a fact. And we have to make certain that they are up to date on what's going on. If our voters come out, you know, so far as this notion of expanding the voter base, if our voters who traditionally understand what we're doing come out, then we're going to be in great shape.
And to bring it back really quickly to how we started this conversation about those protests, are you concerned about that diverse young base of voters that Democrats have been able to rely on in the past? We're seeing a lot of anxiety in that group about Democrats and about President Biden's policies toward Israel and toward Gaza. Mm.
So now I think you have to be concerned. And I think that you need to be honest with folks, and we need to do just what is right. I believe, in as much as when you compare policies, this side versus the other side, at the end of the day, they all understand who best has their back.
Representative Mitchell, we're almost out of time, but specifically black men like you, you know, Kamala Harris was here yesterday in part to appeal to the black voter, black male voters who don't vote at the same proportions as black women and white voters for the most part. How is the campaign, what is the campaign doing to appeal to black men in particular?
Well, I think black men in particular are perhaps the most skeptical about the voter process. And so we have, we've got some great surrogates that's going out. And like I said, I believe they will be on board this, particularly for the presidential election. They came out in a decent clip for the U.S. Senate race with Herschel Walker. And I presume that we'll do even better when it comes to a presidential election. Democrats, if they never come out to vote, they certainly do so during the presidential election.
Well, thank you, State Representative Billy Mitchell, for joining us. That's all the time we have for today's podcast. You can now hear Politically Georgia live on 90.1 WAB in Atlanta, weekdays at 10 a.m., or follow Politically Georgia on your favorite podcast app and hear new episodes every afternoon. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review and share Politically Georgia with a friend. Join us again tomorrow for Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
Donald Trump has been indicted in Atlanta.
We have so many court dockets to follow, but we haven't really seen anything yet.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has covered every moment of this historic case.
I've been writing about this investigation for 2.5 years.
Our team is led by reporters Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman. Follow our coverage on AJC.com and listen to new in-depth episodes of the award-winning podcast, Breakdown, The Trump Indictment, only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.